Chuck Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. The Mariners' home opener, of course, is the Sav Tex 4:10 game, right?
Yes, afternoon.
Exactly. First regular season game. And the choke point involved here is one that I complained about to Chris, exercising my privilege. And it has to do with people who are trying to get back from Seattle Center by taking the tunnel. Whenever there's an event there, it turns out, you can't get onto I-90. So what did we finally decide about that?
Well, let's just remind everybody what you were trying to do, because that's important. Because you were trying to get off, you were going to use the tunnel, or you did use the tunnel, and you were going to get off of the Dearborn Atlantic exit, the first exit you can take out of the tunnel going southbound. And then you were going to skirt over to Edgar Martinez and get to I-90, take a direct shot to I-90.
Yes.
And you were going to impress the heck out of your wife using my private knowledge that I gave you.
I had rehearsed that drive two or three times. Said, oh, boy, you're going to love this, dear.
And when you got off there to take Edgar Martinez, what did you find?
I found the cops were saying you can't take Edgar Martinez. You have to turn right and go right back into town.
Yeah, and the reason was because that was the Sounders match, the first Sounders match of the year. And that was the first event that they had had at the with the new tunnel open, or the new 99 corridor open. And so, you know, I have gone to the Department of Transportation and the Seattle Police about this to talk about, okay, what can we do? Is the traffic control going to change for post games? And the answer is no, because you have to realize how they get everybody out of there. The first thing they do is they close off access to Edgar Martinez in the eastbound direction so they can get everybody out of the parking garage there right next to T-Mobile Park, right? And so you've never been able to go up Edgar, across first or go to Edgar Martinez because of that. That's their plan. And that's not going to change. But you suggested, well, shouldn't they let us know?
Yes.
Is there some way? Can't they do something about the signs? Can't they figure something out?
Put up a little message, just a heads up. You can't get off down there.
And you know what they're going to do?
Yeah, what?
Dave Ross special.
All right.
They've listened to you. Uh-huh. And to me, and to, you know, they've talked to everybody. So starting today with the Mariners home opener, when you are trying to figure out whether or not you should use the tunnel to try to access 99, they are going to activate four variable message signs along the corridor that read, traffic rerouted on South Atlantic exit for I-90, I-5, use other routes.
Uh-huh.
So that gives you at least an indication that if you're going to be using 99 or the tunnel, that you may run into a detour there. So you might want to consider some other options.
That's a pretty long message. Couldn't just say, forget it, Dave.
Well, it could, but that would be a little specific.
I see. Okay.
And here's where they're going to put them. They're going to put them at westbound Mercer at Terry. So like if you're coming out of South Lake Union and you were going to go south on I-5, maybe you didn't want to try to fight through I-5 southbound traffic to get to 99 or get to 90. So there's one there. There's going to be one eastbound at Mercer for people like you who are leaving Seattle Center, right there where you take that right turn at 6th Avenue to go right almost onto the entrance to the tunnel there, right after the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation right there. So there's going to be one there. And then there's going to be one on 99 southbound at Ward Street, so even as you're coming down into South Lake Union, so this is between the Aurora Bridge and South Lake Union, that message board there will read, so, okay, maybe you want to get off at Mercer instead, or just think about, oh, gosh, I'm going to have to ride the tunnel all the way. And then the other one is going to be northbound 99 at Lander, so between the West Seattle Bridge and the stadium. So, for instance, because I know there's some people who don't like messing with the West Seattle Bridge, tying into I-5 and then getting into the collector distributor, it might be faster some days to take 99, peel off before the tunnel, and get onto Edgar Martinez and 90 there. So that's where the four message signs are going to be, and it's a direct result of your coming home from the opera and seeing an issue that you thought needed to be addressed, and the city addressed it. Those signs are going to be up and posted, so at least going forward, drivers won't get caught with their pants down going, what? I can't get to I-90 from here? So there you go. You raised an issue. The city responded.
Thank you, City of Seattle, for saving me any further embarrassment. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now, the host of The Takeout, which you can hear Sunday on Cairo Radio, CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett. This week, you talk with Rudy Giuliani and Jay Sekulow, two of the president's attorneys, and based on what I heard, they are two very happy men after that letter from the attorney general.
They are, and for those in the audience who have sustained curiosity about this story, this is a fascinating interview because I don't involve Rudy Giuliani or Jay Sekulow in the politics that surrounded this whole case. What we really do try to dive into are the legal matters. Why, in their mind, is not only the question of conspiracy or cooperation utterly resolved, but also they are just as confident, though others are not, the question of obstruction of justice is completely resolved and in the president's favor. We also have a very deep discussion about what they consider to be the essence of this story, which is not what the Trump campaign didn't do, but what they believe forces within the FBI did back in the 2016 campaign to lay the predicate for this whole investigation. They believe there's a crime there. And if you're curious about that part of the story, which hasn't gotten a lot of attention, there's a tremendous amount of conversation about that. So you might think that there's a political orientation to that, but really we talk about the legalisms involved. And the president said this week it might have been treasonous. Neither Jay Sekulow or Rudy Giuliani go anywhere near that far, but they do believe there is something there that must be more understood and, if necessary, prosecuted to prevent it from happening again.
So they think that there was a concerted effort among members of the, FBI? To make sure that he never...
FBI, and possibly in collaboration with forces either sympathetic to the Clinton campaign within the FBI or possibly the Obama administration to set this in motion. And they have some pretty striking questions about the conduct of individuals they name within the FBI. Some of those names are kind of familiar. Peter Strzok, an investigator, Lisa Page, Bruce Orr, and... they believe there is something that needs to be scrutinized. Jay Sekulow was very clear. He said, I don't know what happened. I'm not suggesting there are crimes. I'm not an investigator. I don't know the facts. What I do think is something got this ball rolling, and we don't understand exactly how it got rolling. And now that the special counsel, having had all the time, money, subpoena power, etc., found nothing that can be construed to be a conspiracy or a cooperation between this campaign and Russians to interfere in the election. That question got put in motion. It's now been asked and answered, but they believe how that question was first posed and sort of injected into the FBI bloodstream deserves some scrutiny, and there's a lengthy conversation about that.
But, Major, wouldn't Robert Mueller, given his long experience with the FBI, have noticed that if that was an important part of this? I mean, some of these people worked
absolutely
for him.
Absolutely. And that's one of the elements I think that they, both Jay Sekulow and Rudy Giuliani, are with the president on releasing the report, as much of it as you can possibly release. I think they think there are some threads there that can be pursued, some threads there that can be pulled. Now, the fact, and we don't know what the report says, and we don't know if there's anything in there that either the attorney general thought was worthy of summarizing or didn't think was worth summarizing on these underlying questions, that it's not in Bill Barr's, the attorney general's summary, suggests it might not have been raised at all. And you point out very accurately and I think cogently that if Bob Mueller came across something that was untoward, he would have raised it. Having said that, there is an Inspector General report that anyone can read on the Justice Department website right now that does fault lack of protocol in some of these matters that I just discussed with Giuliani and Sekulow. So there is a public record on some of it. It's not a prosecutable public record. It just says mistakes were made. To say, as the president implied, this is a crime, should be prosecuted, takes it to a whole nother level.
Yeah, but it sounds like there is going to be an investigation of the investigation.
I don't think there's any question about it. It's an imperative for the president. He believes he was wronged in this. He has not just a personal stake in this, but he believes, and I'll let the audience evaluate it for themselves. Jay Sekulow and Rudy Giuliani believe there is an institutional matter involved here as well, that there was something untoward and politically malevolent about the origins of this investigation, and to protect future presidents or presidential candidates or nominees from that, some people need to be prosecuted to send a signal to the system writ large. This kind of thing is unacceptable, and if it happens, you will be prosecuted for it.
So what is the effect on all of this on the ability of the president and the Congress to actually get something done that affects the people they govern?
Well, it's a great question, because Republicans, especially those who had been sympathetic to the president and others who had been silent but just hopeful this would all work out, saw the Mueller summary that came from the attorney general on Sunday and said, wow, this is great. The president should ride this for at least a week or two and just say, look, America, I'm in the clear. And this whole thing was, as I described, if not a witch hunt, something that had less foundation than it sounded for so many months. And what does the president and the administration do? It lets that sink in for about a half a day and go straight to Obamacare, completely use the courts to nullify that law, lock, stock, and barrel, shoving House and Senate Republicans into an immediate void politically and legislatively because they don't have a plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. And though they criticize it and say that it has many underlying weaknesses, they don't have a means by which to replace it. So the natural question arises, if you're going to dump this law in the courts or some other way, what are you going to replace it with? We don't know. We haven't sorted out the politics or the policy of that. Republicans are not comfortable, weren't prepared for this argument. So they hoped and expected the president would bask in the post-Mueller glow, if it was one, for at least a week. He didn't even give him a day or two.
Just because I know I have a sort of a cadre of correspondents who every time somebody says something negative about the president point out, you forgot this, you forgot that, you made this up. You can confirm that, in fact, the president does not have a secret health care plan in his back pocket ready to go that he's just not telling us about until the right moment?
No, he does not.
Okay.
And on CBS this morning, we had a soundbite from a question I asked the vice president's new chief of staff, Mark Short, who was the legislative affairs director for the entire White House when the first attempt to repeal and replace the Obamacare Act failed. Do you have a plan? He said, no. The Health and Human Services secretary and his team will have something in a couple of months. So nothing now, at least 2 or 3 months, the nation will have to wait to see whatever it is that the Trump administration puts forward. And Republicans now, and the White House especially, like to say, well, you know, we had votes in the House and Senate. That's true when it was under Republican control in both chambers. But the two bills the Republicans in the House and the Republicans in the Senate attempted to pass were vastly different. There was no agreement among Republicans even back then. There is, I think it's fair to say, less agreement now. And that makes this, as a legislative matter, highly complex, and as a political matter, based on what we learned in the midterm elections, possibly perilous.
CBS News White House correspondent Major Garrett. You can hear The Takeout Sundays right here on Cairo Radio.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's about a 7-year-old Wisconsin girl. She's facing a tough battle with cancer. She's got a brain tumor, Emma, that's inoperable, has no cure, so she's undergoing an aggressive radiation treatment. And a family friend could tell she needed some cheering up. Emma's a dog lover, so the friend wrote her a letter of encouragement in the voice of Emma's dog. And then she asked some friends on Facebook to do the same. The result, pure joy from Emma. The funny letters seemed to do the trick. Keep her mind off the tumor, bring her some joy. And then the Facebook post that was just meant for friends.
Those friends shared it with their friends and so on and so on. And it just literally went viral.
How viral? Fox 6 News in Milwaukee says to date, Emma has received 80,000 letters from dogs around the world. On the day Fox 6 was there to interview the first grader, she was feeling a little tired from her radiation. But mom and dad were by her side, mounds of mail in their home to read the thousands of dog letters to her because they've discovered sometimes kindness is the best medicine.
Stay brave, cutie. Love, Jax.
Jax the dog.
7:47, time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here it is, home opener for the Mariners at T-Mobile Park, the Magenta Meadow. And with us is veteran Mariners reporter Shannon Dreyer. So who are the top prospects? Who will you be looking at especially closely today, Shannon?
Well, I think we're going to be looking at some of the newer Mariners the closest. I think that one that has been a lot of fun to watch was Domingo Santana, who hit the Grand Slam in Tokyo. He really had a super season 2 years ago for the Brewers as a young player and then got displaced by the player who would go on to be the MVP of the league the next year. Didn't get his at-bats, didn't put up his numbers, but he shows just tremendous power. good idea of the strike zone, can run even though he's 6'5". He's been a lot of fun to watch. And the other player that I'm really going to keep an eye on is the guy on the hill, and Marco Gonzalez, who has just come so far since undergoing Tommy John surgery just over 3 years ago. This is a guy out of Gonzaga, so he's going to have to turn that off while he's on the mound, because they're going to be on the court while he takes his first opening day start. He's a guy that was a first-round draft pick, has always had that number one mentality, but really got sidelined with that surgery. And last year, when he was able to find that he was healthy, develop his pitches some more, he got back into that mindset. And you start to wonder, is this guy really closer to a number one than a middle of the rotation guy, or a number two? So he's a lot of fun to watch, too, and just kind of keeping the mind open to possibilities with him, I think should be an intriguing thing for Mariners fans.
And he's actually starting instead of King Felix. He's been not shy about sharing his feelings about the decline in his performance. How's he feeling about not being able to start on this opening day?
You know, I think it's hard for him. He's had a rough few years. It's not just last year. It's kind of been leading into that. And this is the first year in 10 years where he hasn't made that start. It's something that he takes pride in. But you know what? He's been good in the clubhouse. He hasn't let that really kind of take over the clubhouse, that he doesn't feel good about that. And I watched him yesterday. They had a workout at Safeco Field, and Felix didn't get to pitch in one of these exhibition games, didn't get to pitch in one of the games that counted in Japan. They had him throw a sim game in front of an empty stadium yesterday, and you would think that that's got to be one of the most depressing things, but he was Felix. Any day that he gets to pitch, he's excited, he was smiling, he was laughing because he got to pitch, got his work in. So it's going to be tough for him, but he'll have his eye on Monday when he gets his first start.
And how long have you been covering the Mariners now, Shannon?
I covered my first game in 1998.
Yikes. So you have seen players start from scratch, essentially. Start from being on a AAA club and then moving up the ladder. Are you able to see it in the beginning? You know, is there a gleam in their eye that tells you this player is headed for greatness?
Well, I haven't seen a ton of that with the Mariners, but, you know, Felix was one of those. There was no question about that. And then what was exciting this spring training is I did see it. And we saw it early, and these players are a couple of years away, but they've got two prospects that are not only just good prospects, they're potential superstars. And Jared Kelnick, who they got in the Edwin Diaz and Robinson Cano trade, and then Julio Rodriguez out of the Dominican Republic, who they themselves drafted, a pair of 19-year-olds who should move relatively quickly. They not only love to play baseball, but they want the spotlight as well. It's a different era with the social media. They're both putting themselves out there, but they look like they are both tremendous young baseball players, and you get excited about the possibility of them coming up in the next few years.
Yesterday we had Mike Salk on, and he was talking about a possible World Series team come the year 2021-22. Oh, do you care to speculate on when this team might take us to first the playoffs and then the World Series?
What I would like to see is this year's a transition year. In the second half of this year, this team should look very different than it does right now. But I think in 2020, you want to see them really start to take off, particularly in the second half. And you look at teams like the Oakland A's, and that's what they've done on the years that they've made runs to the playoffs. So, you know, maybe they put together a spectacular run in the second half and make the playoffs for the first time in a long, long time in 2021, and then the goal is to keep it going. They tore this down so they could make multiple playoff appearances. They probably could have added to it, taken one final shot, but then what? And you'd just be looking at one wild card situation, perhaps. So 2020 for a playoff is hopeful. 2021 is, I think it's fair to really, with what they've done, really kind of expect that at that point, or 2022, and then to keep it going is the key.
Sports Insider and, I think we can safely say, ultimate Mariners insider, Shannon Dreyer. Shannon, thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
It appears as if Washington State is about to become the 9th state in the nation to raise the smoking age to 21. There is a bill awaiting the governor's signature. And here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
And Dave, this took years to get done, but yesterday, with a 33-12 vote in the state Senate, the legislature passed a bill that raises the age to buy tobacco and vaping products to 21. There were some amendments offered from Republicans, including Senator Mike Patton.
Those folks that have served their country in the armed services, either currently or previously, and happen to be under 21 years of age should have the choice as adults, as people sacrificing for our country, to decide whether or not to use tobacco or vapor products. Now, if I was advising them, I'd advise them not to use those products, but that should be their choice, not the government's choice.
Now, that amendment failed, as did one from Senator Doug Erickson that would have made possessing tobacco or vape products illegal under 21. His argument there was that by making buying them illegal, it would just send underage smokers to neighboring states or to all of the shops on tribal lands in our state where they're under federal law and you could still buy at 18 years old. That one also failed. Democratic Senator Patty Cooter, who, along with Representative Paul Harris in the House, came up with this bill, says the bottom line here is,
if we can get people to the age of 21 without smoking, the odds of them ever picking up that habit dramatically reduce. And that saves lives. It also, coincidentally, saves millions of dollars in related health care.
Republican Senator Phil Fortunato, though, speaking out against the bill.
They're not going to make the right decision about smoking when they're 18. How come they have the right to vote? So if we trust them to vote, we should be able to trust them to, another item would be the firearms, but also to smoke. So either this body is going to say, yes, you are an adult and you're intelligent enough to make your own decisions when you're 18, or you're not.
So he's talking there about some of the same arguments we heard.
Yes.
Which 1639, raising the age to buy semiotic weapons to 21, you know, that's,
well, because at age 18, a switch flips and suddenly you're an adult, just like that, in all areas.
Yeah, and then so the counter on all of this is that just the new study, and it comes up all the time when we're talking about guns, when we're talking about smoking, these kinds of bills here, that the new science is from 18 to 25 years is when your brain is still developing. We're not as developed as maybe we thought we were once a few decades ago in that age range, so that we don't know enough. At any rate, some Republicans did end up voting for this, but two Democrats were also no votes, including Senator Bob Hasegawa, and he had issues with the fact that vape products were included in this.
What are we doing? We're taking away the one option that could actually save lives. What we're doing, it sounds like crazy stuff to me.
I'm just trying to figure out, I've never got an answer to this. Is the problem with smoking the tobacco or the products of combustion, or what is it? Was there any science behind this decision?
Bob Hasegawa had at least five or six studies that he talked about in his speech that all were regarding vape, proving that vaping is not dangerous, proving that vaping is not a gateway to smoking. And yeah, then you had Patty Cooter saying, talking about other studies that show that vaping does lead to smoking cigarettes down the line when we're talking about young people. So what I have found in covering this issue, and I know you had sent me some stuff, that there's been studies that show the chemicals, certain chemicals in certain devices of vaping can cause health issues. It's more the chemicals. I don't know so much right. The nicotine. There's not a lot of agreement on this, as far as I could tell, is what I would say to you on that. Yeah. At any rate, you're going to have to be 21. Now, this is going to the governor's desk. He has said for years that he would sign this. He was very excited about this passing the legislature yesterday. That would make us the ninth state to have to be 21 to buy any tobacco or vaping products. And that would take effect in January of
all right.
Next year.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I'm sure you've read that China has stopped accepting our recycled plastic. And so the question becomes, is recycling dead? Let's talk with Becca Fong, who is outreach planner with Seattle Public Utilities. Is recycling dead?
Recycling is not dead. It is well, good, and alive. It is definitely a different day. Recycling is an interesting industry, and with what was happening in China over the last couple of years, it's evolved, which is actually really great. We started recycling in Seattle in the early 80s. That looked really different back then. We were sorting bins for the folks who were here.
Right.
And so nowadays, you know, we put it all in one bin, and the material is going to further points. So
Further points. If it's not going to China, where's it going?
So it's going to some domestic markets. It really depends on the commodity. So the two things that were really impacted by China's ban were mixed paper and mixed plastics. Mm-hmm. So mixed paper is kind of this really interesting combination of everything paper you can imagine. And China used to take everything all smashed into one bale. So what we're doing now with it to make it a more valuable commodity is we're separating it out.
So who's doing the separation? Because we're not, right?
So, yeah, you're right. We're not doing it. We put it all in one bin. And the reason we chose that was more people recycle and they recycle more material.
Mm-hmm. But they recycle more dirty stuff, right? I mean, it becomes a little closer to garbage when you do that, doesn't it?
Potentially. I think what happens with the single bin system is that folks put a lot of different things in, but the sorting process is pretty robust.
Mm-hmm.
So we have several sorting facilities in the region. The one that Seattle contracts with is down at 3rd and Lander. It is this unbelievably amazing system, mm-hmm. a bit of a Rube Goldberg-type contraption, lots of different belts and optical sorters. And what that does is it separates all the material into different things. So if we go back to the idea of mixed paper, what we're doing now is sorting that paper into different types of paper. So magazines are being sorted out, office papers being sorted out, wow. cardboard being sorted out. And individually, those streams get cleaner. When you mix everything together, you tend to get things that you don't want in it. But if you're separating it out into each individual thing, you get cleaner material, which
and
is
so,
more valuable.
Right. The cleaner it is, the better sorted it is, the more valuable it is. So where – well, first of all, let me ask you. I originally thought that you'd put the plastic in and it would be melted down. It would be reused somewhere nearby. Now we find that for years it's been going off to China to be reused. Now we find it's being extensively sorted by machines and being shipped to various points. Is it still really cheaper, more efficient, and environmentally sound to do all this sorting, washing, and transporting rather than just throwing it out?
It's a really good question, and absolutely it is. So the thing about plastics is that it's made from petroleum, right? So that's pumped out of the ground. That petroleum's transported. It's brought to new manufacturing facilities to make brand new things. When you recycle plastic instead, you shortcut that process. So the petroleum doesn't have to be pulled out of the ground. So even though there is more sorting and there's more transportation, it is less energy intensive to use a recycled product.
And that's been proven scientifically. This is not just being done to make us feel good. It's actually making a difference.
It is. Absolutely. It's definitely making a difference.
Okay, so where is it going now if it's not going to China? Can we give me some examples of where the – if I want to see where my plastic ends up in the form of a product or an ingot or whatever it is they do with it, where could I see that?
Really, the major impact was mixed plastics. When you flip plastics over, they have the little numbers on them.
Right.
3 to 7 is really what was in the mixed plastic. And what our processor here is doing is they are sending them to a secondary material recovery facility that further sorts those 3 to 7s out into mm-hmm. the individual numbers. And that's happening up in British Columbia. And then what they will do is then pelletize the plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's easier to sell that raw material because those pellets are really easy to sell to somebody who's going to make new plastic pop bottles.
But there are other materials, of course. Let's take aluminum, first of all. How's that going?
So aluminum's going really well. There are lots of different markets. What's really great about all the metal that goes into your recycling cart, so you've got aluminum, you've got tin, you've got steel. A really good example, a lot of that metal is going to Nucor Steel, which is the mm-hmm. steel plant right under the West Seattle Bridge. You know, those furnaces are operating 24/7.
So that's being recycled locally.
A lot of that is being recycled locally. They make a huge amount of rebar that goes into the great construction projects that are coming up all over town.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really, really great facility.
Now, what about glass?
Here in the Northwest, we are super fortunate that the glass is being recycled very, very locally within the Seattle city limits. So what's really amazing is that it gets sorted out at the processing plant in mm-hmm. Soto.
So you don't have to sort it by color or don't have to take the labels off?
Not at all. You just put it all in there. Don't have to sort it by color. Don't have to take the labels off. Goes right on a rail car right down to Soto by the First Avenue South Bridge. There's a glass processing plant there. It separates it all out by color through optical sorters. And then literally right next door, that glass goes to the bottle manufacturing plant that makes a lot of bottles for the Washington wine industry.
Really?
Yeah.
So it goes from glass to new wine bottles right here in Seattle.
It does.
See, that's impressive. So it doesn't matter what China does.
No, it doesn't. Not for glass. Not here. We're very fortunate, and it's really great here in Seattle and the Seattle region, kind of circling back to what we were talking about at the top. You know, recycling is not dead, but there's a couple of things that we can all really do that would really, really help keep recycling alive and keep those commodities super valuable. One thing is keeping them empty. So emptying everything out of them, if there's food in it, you know, get that out of there.
How clean?
How clean
do they have to be?
I think a good example would be a peanut butter jar,
yeah.
right? We used to say if there's enough to make a sandwich in it, you need to kind of clean it out.
Yeah. Well, you should use it.
You should use it.
Instead of wasting the peanut butter.
You ate it. You
get the spatula in there
exactly.
and scoop it out. That's what
exactly.
I yes.
Make another sandwich. And now what we want people to do is really rinse that residue out because mm-hmm. it's the mold that can really contaminate the rest of the plastic load. So you want it to be as clean as possible.
Do I have to run it through the dishwasher?
You don't have to run it through the dishwasher. What I do is I fill it with water, put it next to my sink mm-hmm. when I'm starting the dishes, kind of shake it, give it a quick brush with, you know, the sponge.
Do I have to take the label off?
You do not have to take the label off. I just put it upside down on my rack to dry, and I throw mm-hmm. it in there in about an hour in my recycle bin.
Okay, that's not too bad.
No.
And that becomes high-quality recyclable plastic.
It does, then. Absolutely. So empty, clean, and dry. It's really the food contamination that is a problem. And I think that if folks just take, you know, one or two more seconds just to make sure that food's out, it makes a huge difference. Garbage is more expensive. It's the most expensive mm-hmm. thing if you're in Seattle. Recycling, we don't charge extra. That's built into the garbage rate.
Mm-hmm.
And compost is a fraction. In Seattle, we have six different levels of garbage can sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And the smallest one is about 12 gallons. It's pretty tiny.
Yeah.
And it's pretty inexpensive. So if you could get all the way down to that, you're saving a lot. From the littlest can to the biggest can, you've got about an $85 difference.
Oh.
It's pretty significant.
So there is a real incentive.
Oh, absolutely.
To go to the trouble of cleaning out the peanut butter.
Absolutely.
So the message is, despite China's change of heart, recycling is not dead, but it would help if you took a few extra minutes to get the peanut butter out of the plastic, et cetera.
Absolutely. It's a new day for recycling. So recycling is not dead, well and alive. It's going to take all of us to make sure that recycling keeps going and is really successful. And the first step to that is making sure that everything is empty and clean and dry.
Maybe you could persuade North Korea to take our garbage again?
I don't know about that.
Could be negotiated. I understand we're pretty good friends with the guy. Becca Fong is outreach planner for Seattle Public Utilities. Becca, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There you go. So you're going to clean out your peanut butter jars now?
No, I'm going to do what I always do. Just throw them in throw everything in a big hole in the backyard.
Well, that works.
Because it's fun. Because when we, you know, cut open things at the old family 115-year-old beach house,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're digging around in the backyard, we mm-hmm. find the most interesting bottles
I'll
and things that they, that's
well,
how they dealt with the garbage back in the day.
You're helping future archaeologists understand what our civilization was like.
Yeah.
I think it was based on your habits, but, you know.
Yeah, especially whatever. Those non-biodegradable pizza boxes that I usually use and all the things that kill the planet. Yeah.